This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Now, what had just happened with these rumors, if they are true, that Uganda forces are moving into South Sudan, this will also build up escalations. So people are worried. South Sudan is being worried of this development.
That was Daniel Akech, senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, discussing the deployment of Ugandan troops to South Sudan. Details coming up also. The U.S. initiates talks with the Democratic Republic of Congo. And tariffs combined with fears of inflation has sent the U.S. stock market tumbling. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The Democratic Republic of Congo is looking to the United States in its bid to find an ally in the government's battle against the M23 rebels. Republican strategist Joe Sislavik, who is in Kinshasa, has confirmed to VOA that early talks between the Trump administration and the DRC government are underway. He tells VOA's Carol Van Damme that President Donald Trump will soon name Massad Bolos to be a special U.S. special envoy to the Great Lake region. Bolos is an American businessman and the father-in-law of the president's daughter, Tiffany, with previous business experience in Nigeria.
There are initial talks between the United States and the Congo. As a matter of fact, I think it's unofficial, but President Trump will be announcing an envoy to the Great Lakes, Dr. Bolos, has been kind of selected to come to the region to discuss with Congo and Rwanda how some of the conflict can be resolved, and then also engaging with the Congolese and companies like Gécamines on how the United States can participate in the mineral wealth of the Congo.
So, yes, there is talks underway.
Yes, they're initial talks and I would say that there's an exchange of communication. However, I think those channels of communication are being formalized.
Why are these negotiations going on right now between the U.S. and the DR Congo?
I think there's concern about the elevation of conflict between the Rwandans and the Congolese. And, of course, the Angolans are working hard in the Luanda process to try to get the parties to stop fighting. And I think the reality is when you look at eastern Congo, truly the instability is really over mineral rights. And there's been a precedent for over 30 years, basically, of Rwanda accessing Congolese mineral rights, I will say unofficially. And maybe the idea is to try to find a mechanism whereby this commerce can be more formalized and, you know, tariffs and whatnot can be used. And instead of spending money on militarization of the region, those funds could be basically reutilized in terms of developing the regional economy, possibly, you know, for the benefit of both countries.
M23 fighters reportedly backed by neighboring Rwanda, although Rwanda denies that, have made big advances in mineral-rich parts of the country in the east, like you mentioned. Is President Felix Tshisekedi worried that they're going to make it all the way to Kinshasa at this point, which is a pretty far ways away from where they're at right now? It's like 1,000 miles, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't think in Kinshasa there's concern about the M23 or the Rwandans coming to take over Kinshasa. I think, actually, if that were to happen, I think it would be very bad news for President Kagame to destabilize the Congo. I think the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and others have made it very clear that that would be unacceptable. And as to the mineral rights in the east, you're not going to find Western investment come into that area as long as M23 is in that area terrorizing the population. So, look, unequivocally, everyone knows that Rwanda is backing M23 as its proxy and that there are Rwandan defense forces in Congo. This has been a paradigm for the last 30 years. And, you know, billions of dollars have been spent to bring peace, and it hasn't happened. In the reality, this is more of an economic war than anything else. And hopefully the parties can find a way to come up with a solution. But like I said, the Congolese are asking that their sovereignty be respected. And then obviously the Rwandans are here. But look, every day there are minerals, wood, lumber, and other strategic and critical minerals that go back and forth through the border illegally. So maybe the real idea is finding a way to have that trade more, say, formalized, official. And if you think, if you could kind of get that mechanism in place, both countries would not have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of defense and military action in the region.
Do you know if those M23 rebels, are they controlling any of this? You talk about how it's kind of like a illegal black market thing going on with some of the sale of these items, the lumber, the precious metals. Do the rebels have some of that right now?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of gold, tantalum, and coltan that are currently being exported to Rwanda. There's a couple mines. I think one of them's called Lulabaya, if I'm correct. That mine's been taken over by the rebels. And if the rebels aren't themselves proactively mining it, the people or the local communities that are mining it are basically being charged a surcharge for those minerals to move.
So we know that there's some valuable resources there, and we know that what the U.S. wants. What would the DR Congo government get out of this?
Well, I think, look, the reality is you've had China heavily invested in the Congo. I mean, a lot of it's through, and this has happened under the previous administration, but there was a lot of corruption involved in some of these mega deals. And under President Tshisekedi, they've tried to reset some of these deals whereby the Chinese have been forced to pay money that was owed to the state. And I think they're trying to diversify their investor base. And of course, the United States and other Western countries are very interested in coming and developing these assets in Congo. So in the Congolese context, diversifying investment, critical strategic minerals are very important. And I think if they could kind of stabilize the country and, there could be peace with Rwanda, I think you would see a major uptick in investment, and it would be probably to the benefit of both countries.
That is Republican strategist Joe Sislavik speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Kinshasa. While Kigali denies directly backing the M23 rebels, it has said its troops are operating in the eastern DRC to defend the Rwanda's sovereignty and borders. In addition, Rwanda accuses the DRC of sheltering a militant group that aims to overturn the government in Kigali. South Sudan's government has denied earlier reports that Uganda has deployed an unknown number of troops to Juba in a bid to protect the government of President Salva Kiir, as a tense rivalry with his deputy Riek Machar threatens a return to civil war. However, the UN is warning of an alarming regression that could erase years of hard-won progress in South Sudan. From Nairobi, Daniel Akech, a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, discussed the threat of South Sudan returning to civil war with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shinawi.
The threat is credible, but it depends on the actions of the two principals, the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, and the first vice president, Riek Machar, two leaders who tipped South Sudan into civil war in 2013 when the conflict broke out over competition within the South Sudanese politics. Now, what had just happened with these rumors, if they are true, that Uganda forces are moving into South Sudan, this will also build up escalations. So people are worried. South Sudan is being worried of these developments that have been happening in the last few days.
The latest tensions stem from fighting in the country's north between government troops and a rebel militia known as the White Army that's widely believed to be allied with Machar. Kiir and Machar are under pressure from the United States and others to move quickly to implement the 2018 peace deal and prepare for elections scheduled for 2026. What prompted this latest fighting?
There has been a build-up. One is that South Sudan has been stuck in this agreement that brought two leaders together in 2020 to form a coalition government. This government has been struggling to keep afloat due to dwindling resources. War broke out in Sudan in April 2023. That war has created a number of issues for South Sudan, at least three of them. One is it disrupted oil flows, and South Sudan government has been depending for its revenues on oil that is transported to the world market through Sudan. And 90% of oil revenues for the government of South Sudan comes from oil. Also, the war in Sudan has been sending back returnees who were refugees sent into Sudan during the civil war in 2013. These refugees are returning into a fragile environment. This is also creating humanitarian emergencies for South Sudan, for which South Sudan has not been able to address. And then third is the influx of illegal arms because the South Sudan has a long border with Sudan. And this border, when the war erupted in Sudan in 2023, South Sudanese youth militias joined the fight because of desperations. And they joined the fight. They've been fighting on both sides of the Sudanese conflicts as low-grade mercenaries. These conditions had created pressures in Juba. And the reaction of the president has been to restructure his security forces in the country. By doing that, the first vice president, Machar, has accused the president of violating the terms of the existing agreements. And this, the latest accusations came up in February, and then it was followed by attempts by the president to redeploy forces into places like Nasser in Upper Nile. And this triggered new spikes in violence in Nasser. So this was the build-up to that. The provocations were coming from these pressures, internal pressures within South Sudan.
So how do you explain the instability in South Sudan since its separation from Sudan?
South Sudan politically became independent from Sudan in 2011, but it has remained dependent on Sudan in a lot of ways. One is that South Sudan is importing food from Sudan, and at the same time, it's exporting its oil through the Sudanese land. And this is the South Sudan is depending on this oil for survival, especially the governments and the elites. So the glue that has been holding these elites together is this oil money, which is coming from the Sudanese land. That's the land through which it is taken to the market. So South Sudan cannot survive without Sudan. So a crisis in Sudan, when it broke out, it created one large problem of creating a physical crisis right away in South Sudan, which has been growing, making it difficult for government to pay its civil servants and organized forces. This is creating a problem where the armed forces are engaging in extortions throughout the country. And the second one is the influx of arms is also encouraging non-state actors to pick up guns and use those guns as they walk in and out of South Sudan. So the vulnerability is so high that the conflict system in South Sudan and the one in Sudan could actually merge, because the area where we are seeing crisis now in Upper Nile is too close to Sudan. It's bordering Sudan, where the conflict is also ongoing.
That was Daniel Akeche, a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group, speaking from Nairobi with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Members of the Regional Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, today issued a call for all hostilities to end in South Sudan. They said, "There is an urgent need for a dialogue among the country's leadership." IGAD said South Sudan is balanced precariously between the promise of peace and the peril of conflict. And the grouping said the 2018 revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict remains the most viable path towards securing stability. The African Union today said the announcement of a parallel government in war-torn Sudan risks cleaving the country ravaged by nearly 2 years of unrest. According to the French news agency AFP, the AU has condemned the announcement by the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, of establishing a parallel government in war-torn Sudan. And the AU warns that such action carries a huge risk of partitioning of the country. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, VOA Africa is now available on WhatsApp. To share your input on our broadcasts or receive our daily news updates, text us on +1 202 322 7501. You can also follow us, our WhatsApp channel, by searching for our username, VOA Africa. U.S. President Donald Trump says his administration initiated the most extensive border and immigration crackdown in history during his recent speech to Congress. He said 21 million immigrants entered the U.S. illegally during the presidency of his predecessor, Joe Biden. According to U.S. Border Patrol statistics, around 7 million migrants were arrested for illegal crossings at the U.S.-Mexico border during that time, including repeat offenders. VOA's Paul Indijo spoke with Chinua Isimai, president and CEO of Skepter 3 Global Advisors, a risk management company, about President Trump's immigration policy.
There's been a significant shift in the administration's policy as it relates to immigration, and most of that is around enforcement. So we've had a number of immigration laws in the books, but there's been a lot of frustration, especially over the last few decades, but it's really mounted in the last 4 years because there seemed to be a very deliberate posture and position by the prior administration, either not to enforce some of the laws on the books or to put in place certain programs that made it easier for immigrants to either obtain or apply for asylum and then violate those applications or to come into the U.S. So there seemed to be a very different posture with the prior administration, and President Trump is now enforcing those laws that have been on the books for a really long time.
President Trump ran on this issue, and the Americans agreed with him, but he has continued to get a lot of criticism in regard to how they have carried out some of these deportations. You and I come from Africa. There are a lot of Africans who have been deported, whose families have been, you know, affected by these deportations. Your thoughts on that?
You were very right in noting that the president did run on this. He identified a high degree of frustration in a lot of American cities. If you look across New York City, which has traditionally been a melting pot, there have been a lot of concerns around the increase in violent crime in the streets, but also around taxpayer dollars funding immigration, immigrants, residents in hotels, helping them start businesses. And you just think about the tension that that creates between, you know, American-born citizens and people who are migrants, right? So you have certain American citizens who struggled for a long time to save up to start their businesses, to run their businesses, to maintain them. And then they see immigrants come who have their homes paid for, their residence, maybe not homes. In certain places, it is homes. They were being put in homes, but in New York City hotels. So that raised a lot of concern. So I think as the administration is implementing the strategy, they do need to be careful as to the impact. They do need to be open to tweaking the strategy to make sure it's not reaching unintended consequences. So while carrying out the promises made on the campaign trail, how do you make sure that you're not impacting people that otherwise you may not want to impact? The administration, I think, is executing it to the best of their abilities. And there have been instances, whether on the business side or on the immigration side, where even supporters of President Trump may have been impacted by some of this, right? So I think it's a time of realignment, it's a time of readjustment. And hopefully, once we have more of a steady state, with the transition, I think we will be able to see laws that are more predictable, where people understand what the consequences are for certain actions, and maybe there's a little bit less fear about potential repercussions, but there's more understanding of what the administration's policy is and how people can expect to comply.
That was Chinua Isimai, President and CEO of Skepter 3 Global Advisors. She spoke to VOA's Paul Indijo. Nigerian authorities confirmed that a meningitis outbreak in the northwest was behind the death of at least 26 people over several weeks. The State Commissioner for Health, Musa Ismail, told the Associated Press and other news media that the spread of the disease in the state of Kebbi began in late January with over 200 suspected cases recorded. Ismail also said medical supplies have already been dispatched to the affected areas and isolation centers set up to prevent the further spread of the disease. Sokoto, another state in the northwest and about 90 miles away from Kebbi, has urged residents to remain vigilant after several cases were suspected. talks of tariffs combined with fears of inflation sent the U.S. stock market tumbling Monday and again on Tuesday, a day of give and take between the United States and Canada, with President Donald Trump defending his use of tariffs. VOA White House correspondent Carolyn Prasutti explains.
Day two, another plunge of the U.S. stock market. President Donald Trump escalating an already tense trade war. The president threatening to double tariffs on Canadian metals after Canada's intent to raise the price of electricity exports to the U.S. At the end of the day, both men backing down, leaving stocks shaken. The president still plans the original 25% tariffs on Canada to promote products made in America.
The right thing to do is what we're doing. We're going to get our jobs back, and we're not going to be left at.
For the past 36 years, Ramon Pereyas has managed Taberna del Alabadero. His business lived through COVID and the tariffs of President Trump's first term.
I remember 2018, 2020. It's going to be politician is a game, right?
The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 900 points Monday and nearly 500 Tuesday. Losses felt in Roger Frechette's retirement account.
It's really tough to see all that value disappearing so quickly. I think much of what has been gained the entire year is now probably gone.
People are jumping to conclusions, and it's a little overreacting right now, so we'll see. Give it like 30 days to see what the effects of these tariffs and everything, because even President Trump keeps changing his mind. So who knows?
Financial analysts say it's that unpredictability that stings. Lena Mosley is an expert on the global economy at Princeton University.
It's hard for investors and for businesses and for American consumers to sort of know what the future policy environment looks like. Getting more certainty there, I think, would be helpful to people.
When asked if he predicts a recession, President Trump said, "I don't see it at all." Many, though, are looking to the stock market to answer that question. Carolyn Prasutti, VOA News, The White House.
The body of a Kenyan police officer who died in Haiti's United Nations-backed multinational mission to combat violent gangs has been returned home. The Associated Press says the body of Samuel Tompo Ketuai was on Monday night received by his family and senior police officers. The officer died on February 23rd after he was fatally shot by gangs in western Haiti. No date has been announced for his funeral. A contingent of around 800 Kenyan police is leading the mission that includes soldiers and police from countries such as Jamaica, Guatemala, and El Salvador, who are working alongside Haiti's national police. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.